So maybe open your jacket?
Sure.
And let's just put that in there.
Okay.
Because nothing should happen. Just should go going. Yeah.
Okay.
And we'll just do all that inside. And then maybe on this side.
It's binaural? Or is it just
it's
backup?
Just two microphones.
Yes.
Yeah, because I mean, the wind sometimes is through
right.
Inside.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Oh, it'll make the sound quality better.
Do you have any phase problems or anything, you know? Are you going to show stuff?
Sure, I can if you have questions about it. Sure, no, it definitely is out of place. I don't know if there's anything you can do about it. I could put on a hat instead. I don't know if there's anything you can do about it. I've been wearing a hat all day. Okay.
You really can't see from down there, can you?
It's not the hair. Okay, you start.
And what I really think, I don't know, what I found impressive is like what you said this morning about the conceptual framework or your thoughts in organizing the kickoff and why you did this as kickoff.
Okay.
And I don't know, how was it? Shanai didn't talk in that. She did talk a little in the past tense, right?
You mean the details of the...
Yeah.
I mean, so what I think partly is going to be the result of this is sort of a document of the weekend.
Cool.
So it's also good to be quite specific about this is what Sadie was kind of teaching me, because it's both a matter of talking about the conceptual, you know, the kind of high-level abstract thought.
But reference specific examples where possible.
Today we were at the much as you can.
Yep.
I also was thinking as I was walking over here that I'd love to talk to you a little bit about what happened with the land acknowledgement, how you feel about land acknowledgements.
Sure.
And that's
I don't know. It might make me, get choked up again. Yeah, we'll see. We can try. We can go in that direction, but
that's also cool. Right? But I just think because of what we saw today.
Right. Sure. No, it always gets me choked up. So it's hard for me to talk about.
That's also interesting, though. Like, can you talk about why it gets you choked up?
Probably not. That would get me more choked up than the actual land acknowledgement statement. But I don't know. We can try.
Okay, so what we could do is start with a question around where we are right now.
Sure.
And why we kind of came to this place.
Okay.
But we should also probably have on camera his introduction of himself.
Yeah.
Right, so who are you and how would you like to present yourself?
Okay. So my name's John Kim. I'm a professor at McAllister College in Media Cultural Studies. I came on board on this project in January of 2018 or so, and I got contacted to be involved with the project in part because of some pre-existing work that I had been doing around what I was referring to as Mississippi studies. What I was trying to develop in collaboration with a number of institutions and individuals up and down the Mississippi was a critical area studies about the Mississippi River, trying to imagine the Mississippi River as a coherent cultural corridor that could link and connect researchers, artists, intellectuals, activists, politicians, etc., chefs, up and down the entirety of the Mississippi River in ways that might help us break out of what I perceived as certain kinds of impasses, deadlocks when it comes to the ways in which America, especially in this region, is increasingly thinks about itself, namely the way in which we divide the country up into north and south, east and west, red and blue, rural, urban. And so what I was trying to accomplish with Mississippi Studies was to try to reimagine the Mississippi, or try to imagine the Mississippi as a sense of belongingness that allowed us to identify ways in which we shared a common geography, river, cultural corridor that allowed us to speak across these differences that I thought were increasingly manifesting themselves in more and more polarized ways. And so that was my motivation for getting involved with this idea of Mississippi Studies. I had been organizing some conferences and gatherings and meetups with researchers up and down the Mississippi River in trying to formulate this project. It was serendipity that the Hakeve reached out very early on in my attempt to try to start the process of forming Mississippi Studies. and said that they had this project in which they wanted to focus on the Mississippi River in its entirety. And so it seemed like the perfect opportunity, right, to approach this question of trying to think about the Mississippi River as a coherent cultural corridor. And even though the Anthropocene for me wasn't necessarily a research area of focus, it quickly became an opportunity to think about these questions around the Mississippi that I'd already been exploring, but focusing it concretely on climate change, the Anthropocene, human activities up and down the Mississippi. And so, you know, I really jumped into this opportunity and really tried my hardest to develop some content around the project. And luckily, I was able to take this fall off from my teaching responsibilities at McAllister College to join the river journey from the headwaters, which is where we are currently at Lake Itasca, all the way down to the Gulf.
Excellent. It's interesting that you juxtapose this corridor to the divisiveness that's arising in America these days, like some kind of a linking element that is in opposition to the... Yeah, I've not heard that idea. In your speech before. So I guess maybe a way to start what is a reflection on why we're here and what we're doing is, you know, just to situate ourselves as sitting, you know, on a lawn at a field station in Itasca Lake, mm-hmm. which is ostensibly the headwaters, the beginning of a river that is something you would like to project as a cultural, contiguous cultural corridor. And, like, why are we here? What mm-hmm. What is the significance of that beginning for you, and what happened in the last couple of days?
So currently we're sitting at Lake Itasca, on the banks of Lake Itasca, which is characterized as the headwaters of the Mississippi River. And as we heard from Frank Bibeau, an Ojibwe activist and scholar, yesterday, this depiction of Lake Itasca as the headwaters of the Mississippi is very much contested by Native thinkers and scholars, partly because this way of thinking about the headwaters as the geographically highest point along the Mississippi doesn't necessarily speak to any other valence or mode by which to think about the source of the river. And for Ojibwe at Leech Lake, as Frank Bibeau was describing to us yesterday, of course, Leech River, which flows out of Leech Lake, which is the homeland of the Ojibwe currently, is of greater importance to the Ojibwe because it flows into the Mississippi and becomes an important cultural and commercial and religious corridor for them to connect to the world around them, but nevertheless, I mean, I think I was interested in helping to organize an event up here at Lake Itasca for precisely the contested status of the lake as the headwaters of the Mississippi, both from a scientific perspective, but also from a cultural perspective, because it opens up a door to thinking about the ways in which that contestation around how we understand what the headwaters to be still has implications for the way in which we organize space and the politics that govern it. So, for example, in thinking about an additional reason why I think it was important to come up to Lake Itasca and then to make stops along the way, because part of our activities over the last few days wasn't just to visit Lake Itasca, but to use the trip itself from the Twin Cities up to Lake Itasca as an opportunity for site visits as well. And so I think some of the most important activities that are going on with regard to the question of the Anthropocene are happening here in the headwaters region, not just Lake Itasca, but the region itself. And it circulates around the issue of indigenous resurgence and political activism, specifically organized around resistance to the Line 3 Enbridge oil pipeline. And when thinking about, like, the concept of the Anthropocene, I think it's important to acknowledge both that one way of thinking about the origin of the Anthropocene is the colonization of the New World, right? How that began the long process of colonization and the intensification of extraction and capitalist processes here in the New World, which ultimately unleashed a lot of the productive forces that have ultimately led to climate transformation, climate change. But what I think is really important is that that at this nexus of native activism and oil extraction, it's a galvanizing force today and forms of resistance to the conditions that have led to the creation of the anthropogenic conditions that are being described by the Anthropocene, right? And so so I thought that the Headwaters region in its entirety, and as we saw yesterday in driving around Lake Itasca, there's a lot of sites where the Line 3 oil pipeline crosses rivers, streams that flow out of Lake Itasca. I think this is one of the most important regions in which to think about the Anthropocene, precisely for how it references multiple ways in which to interpret what the Anthropocene is, both from its colonial perspective, but also from the extraction of resources that are leading to climate transformation, climate change.
I was talking to Claire yesterday, and she was talking about how also it sort of brings out the difference between imaginaries and reals, because obviously the contestation of the headwater itself, right, is one of these things that gives you back its mythology by just noting that it's not impossible to have a beginning of a river somehow. But this is all the tensions that are about how we even understand
right.
an imaginary of a river, right? Like, how do you picture the Mississippi?
Right, yeah.
How do you get that in your mind?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I guess to just maybe get a little bit more about where we are and what you're thinking about to get on a boat. You're one of the people that's doing the entire thing.
Right.
This is a fascinating thing to do to yourself and to the world. And so I'm super curious, like, you know, how you think it's going to feel to get into the headwaters, like not just be here in a kind of sense of the anthropocenic discussion and stuff like that, but for you to enter a boat,
sure.
you know, and kind of begin that journey.
Like, yeah.
What's in your mind?
That's a great question. Right before we traveled up to Lake Itasca, I had the good fortune of going out to Washington State and hike the Wonderland Trail, which is the trail that circumambulates Mount Rainier. And, you know, because I've been put in this mindset of thinking about geologic time, that became the frame of reference by which I was thinking about the organization of that hike. And what I was really moved and struck by was how well constructed the Wonderland Trail was to move you through structures of deep time, or to move you through deep time. You're constantly traveling down old growth forests, and then you're traveling up through the glacial valleys through like primary succession vegetation, and then you're hiking up to the foot of a glacier, and then you're hiking above and on top of a glacier, and then you're hiking up to unglaciated areas on top of Mount Rainier. And I was really struck by the power of the organization of that trail as an opportunity for thinking about these questions of deep time in the Anthropocene. And I think part of how this project has really influenced the way in which I think about this region, like Lake Itasca and the Headwaters, is that I'm thinking about this trip that we're going to be taking, this journey that we're going to be taking down the Mississippi River, in those ways, right? What are the ways in which we can experience new forms of temporality, new spatialities that aren't necessarily available to us as we move through the normal space and time, right? And so one of the things that I expect to feel in traveling by boat is a different sense of temporality, and that's the temporality of just the time of the speed of a canoe, and how that will vary according to our travel in slower sections of the river, like the Mississippi Creek that flows out of Lake Itasca, but and the faster rates at which we'll travel on the lower Mississippi when the Mississippi River starts to travel at greater speeds, and the ways in which we can measure our speed against the commercial traffic that will be passing by us on a daily basis, right? And so temporality, I think what I expect to feel is these shifts of temporality, not just in an immediate sense, in the sense of a kinesthetic movement through through space, but also as Connie Cox was describing to us earlier today when she was giving who's the state naturalist for Lake Itasca was explaining to us the glacial history of this region and why there are a succession of a series of lakes immediately in this vicinity of Lake Itasca. She was talking about it as part of the history of glaciation and the retreat of the Ice Age. And I'm also expecting to experience some of that as well in the canoes. And so it's not just the temporality of being in a canoe, but it's these deep temporalities that I think I'll also be able to experience while traveling by canoe.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like an experiential, like I've been to Mount Rainier, and that's an amazing hike, but it's like, it's really a geological mindset, whereas mm-hmm. like somehow this feels like it's almost like this versus this, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like you'll be going through the
sure.
landscape.
And sure, like that right. Yeah, there aren't nearly as many features by which to recognize or acknowledge the fact that you are moving through glaciated space, right? Because you're constantly moving up and down and being able to look down into the glacial ravines, whereas here we're going to be traveling horizontally, basically, yeah. and not being able to see that.
Yeah, it's almost like two different travels through glaciality somehow. Like, you know, like one of them is
new valleys.
It's melted water, for God's
right.
sake.
It's all new, whereas this is old glacier. I mean, older forms of glacial activity, I think.
So just, I guess one of the parts of the deep time sensibility is, of course, what you brought up already, which is that the Anthropocene kind of maybe occurs at different moments for different people or, you know, or different locations in different ways. The Earth never changes as an object, you know, as a totality. And those times also bring in the indigenous. And mm-hmm. so without going anywhere that makes you uncomfortable, but and tell me if we can skip it if it does. But I'm interested in your relationship to that.
Sure.
How you characterize your politics and personal politics, I guess.
Sure.
Indigenous rights issues,
right.
Land management claims, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, both in this region, but then just like it seems to be something that you seem to live it somehow.
Hmm.
And if you could speak about that in any way.
Sure, right. Yeah, that's a great question. I've never really actually had to speak about it because it isn't necessarily something that I write about it. And so, you know, I don't know.
We could like an entry point might be like, how do you feel to be at the burial grounds today?
Yeah. I actually wasn't. I was like moving through really quickly because I was trying to do multiple things. So I didn't really have a chance to experience that well. So.
Okay, well,
I was there, but I was running around trying to do a few things.
Or with Dawn,
yeah. I see what you're asking. I'm just trying to ground it within concrete details. Yeah, I don't know. It's. I think as an immigrant to this country, a recent immigrant to this country, I experience in a immediate sense the colonial legacy of America around the world, right? I mean, the reason why my parents moved to the United States was precisely because of what you could call a colonial war of aggression by the communists and by the Americans within the Korean Peninsula. And so that produces in me a sense of real colonial displacement.
Just let the wind flow through you, man. It's okay. We can also just move something
Let's
else.
Move something else.
Okay. So there's a trip ahead of you, and there's going to be some people on it with you, and there's probably some hopes in your minds.
Yeah.
Probably some. I mean, nobody can avoid expecting something from what that experience might do to you or do to the world, as I sort of keep juxtaposing, but it's kind of the same thing. So you're going to end up in New Orleans in, what, 2 months, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I guess, yeah, it's about maybe projecting your mind into that moment, with all impossibilities that entails. Obviously, you can't do that, but you could either do it from your own perspective, like what you think you might be feeling,
sure,
when you enter the Delta,
right,
or see the city of New Orleans rising on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
That would be at a moment. Or just like what you hope the group is going to get out of this. Like,
sure.
Or what the, you know, it's such a big thing to do.
Right.
There must be,
right,
something.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, as I was talking about earlier, one of my hopes for working on this project was to start thinking about the Mississippi River as a coherent cultural corridor. And when I started working on this project, I had an opportunity to organize a few conferences that brought people together from different locations up and down the Mississippi. But never was there an experiential, deep, thoughtful, critical opportunity to have conversations and do site research and do visits to places that enabled us to really start to recognize or understand what that might actually mean. Like, what are the ways in which we could actually define the Mississippi River as a coherent kind of corridor with shared cultural issues, social and political ones as well? And one of the really amazing benefits that I've had in working on this project up to this point already, which will guide what I'm about to say about the experience of going down to New Orleans, is this opportunity to actually go to St. Louis to travel down there. And in preparation for this trip, I also went down to New Orleans to spend a bunch of time doing some site research and visits with different people and activists and groups down there. And so, and at each one of these opportunities, it has been a deep engagement or an attempt to create a deep engagement with people, with communities, with communities of color, with pressing social, economic, and environmental issues that have really galvanized the sense that there are these shared questions and concerns and thematics that connect us up and down the Mississippi, right? And so now that we're at the beginning of this trip, I think some of those thematics, and I don't necessarily have a definition for them yet, but they're in the background of my thinking of this journey. But some of these thematics are definitely sort of rising to the forefront as opportunities for thinking about what it might actually mean to approach this question of trying to discover within the Mississippi River a shared cultural corridor, right? And so what I'm hoping and what I'm expecting to experience when we arrive at the Gulf is a clearer, more crystalline sense of what those thematics are and how it might shape my perception of the Mississippi River in ways that might connect the various and diverse geographies that the Mississippi runs through.
Great, yeah. So just to feel all that, and like also have a more kind of what?
Yeah,
greater resolution around these. Different,
yeah, because I think it's in addition to the canoe aspects of the journey, at each one of these field stations that we're going to be journeying through, it's going to be this real embedded, critical, experiential learning experience. And I think when if you're asking about the embodied experience of this canoe trip, I can't exclude any of that kind of stimulation from this experience as well. And I think what's going to emerge in being able to travel and see these geographies and topographies and communities and culture and cultures is precisely a capacity to recognize what these thematics might be. And I think the Hakeve has done a really good job in trying to preliminarily define some of these. Property, temporality, commodity, etc., exhaustion. But I still leave the page open to redefining and reimagining some of these thematic observations to the experience of traveling down the river until we get down to the Gulf.
Great, cool. It's I'm going to write something. I'm writing these little kind of entries for that system as well, and there's one I wanted to write about the river as an organizing organizing principle and the river as a disorganizing principle. Mm-hmm. It's like sort of like a sifting effect, right? Like mm-hmm. where you start to see things more clearly, but then also, and the river itself has this effect all the time, right? Like it sort of organizes human activity, but then occasionally it just floods.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's also shifting like a design
process. Right.
So you get yeah. zero resolution and then you kind of come back to something.
Yeah, right.
Do you want to talk about any of this?
Sure. Yeah.
So I can ask you questions about
it. Nope.
Yeah. We just do this as a kind of middle piece, and then because I think that last thing you said is a good bookending.
Sure.
But this is just well, so how would go before you do.
Okay, before I do anything, right?
Maybe put it down, actually.
Okay.
So it has a transition. And so you're here also as a citizen scientist type of activator, action maker. Person, and so maybe you could talk a little bit about what you're going to do, and
sure.
like what kind of instruments and objects you're going to bring into play.
So I'm working on two research art projects in conjunction with my work on this project. One is a short film that I'm working on, and then another project that I'm working on is this data sensing device that I've been creating just for this river journey. Early on in conversations with the Hakeve and the Max Planck Institute, we were talking about ways in which we could engage scientists, social scientists, in this project. How could we gather data that could be useful or valuable, both for research or pedagogy, for aquatic ecologists, to pollution scientists, and so one of the questions became like, how can we collect data that's useful quantitatively for scientists? And some of my background is at the intersection of art and data. I do a lot of work around aesthetics and computation, art and data, and so I have a background in custom hardware and software design, in computational ways of artistic representation, or using computation and artistic representation. And in fact, one of the last projects that I worked on was a sculptural, and I worked on this project with a team of artists and architects called Futures North, and it was a sculptural representation of the deep history, of the deep temporal history of the Mississippi River, of the upper Mississippi River. You know, Harold Fisk's maps of the lower Mississippi River are quite famous and gorgeous for showing the braided nature of the Mississippi River, but he never got further north of, I believe, St. Louis, so he never created meander maps of their upper Mississippi. At the same time, there are different geological conditions that wouldn't have led to the same kinds of braidedness, but there definitely was a lot of movement of the Mississippi River, even on its upper stretches. And so what we did was we collected contemporary satellite imagery of the borders of the Mississippi River, and we mined historical maps, GIS maps of the borders of the Mississippi River, and then we collected the earliest maps that were made of the Mississippi River going all the way back to Joseph Nicolet, and then used computational processes to connect them all in order to create a sculptural meander map. And so a lot of my work is at the intersection of environment, art, data mining, computation, etc. And so I was really interested in this idea of collecting a new set of data in conjunction with the experience of going down the river, and then using it both live and then after the fact, and after the end of the journey, for aesthetic or scientific visualizations. And so what I've been doing over the last couple of months is talking with different research scientists, scientific research scientists, to see if they would be interested in making use of some of this data. And I found a few aquatic ecologists and river specialists and spatial geography people and statisticians who are interested in making use of some of this data. And so I've created this device in order to collect live data So this device is going to be traveling with us all the way down the river to the Gulf, and it's going to be collecting live data across a number of different parameters that are going to be sent live into the cloud for both real-time visualization on Hakebe's new website, but then also research scientists at different institutions, colleges, and universities are going to be trying to make use of that data for their research, but primarily pedagogical purposes as well. And so this device collects data across a whole number of parameters. This device up here is the GPS, so it's collecting spatial information, altitude information, right, speed, geolocational information, etc. This device over here is one that I'm actually most interested in, and I'm working with an art and technologist to create visualizations of it. But it's a kinetic sensor, so basically it shows gyroscopic information and accelerometer information, which I think will be really powerful as an embodied experience of being on the river, right? Because it'll be collecting information about how the boat is moving through the water, how much we're pitching, if we fall off the boats, it'll show that as well. It'll show our speed through the water, and provided that we can come up with some really interesting aesthetic visualization of it, it might give people a sense of what it would feel like to be on the river, both live and traveling with us, but then also as an archive of our movement through the water. And then there's an air sensor, an atmospheric sensor. It collects data across a whole bunch of atmospheric parameters, including volatile organic chemicals that I thought would be really interesting, especially as we move down into Louisiana and Cancer Alley, where there's a high density of petrochemical industries. And then there's a few water sensors as well that are determining temperature. But then we have this other device that we're going to collate with the data that this guy's collecting, that's going to be collecting information across a whole bunch of water quality parameters, pH, salinity, turbidity, nitrate, dissolved oxygen. Yeah.
Great. Yeah, those are well explained. What's the main thing running on?
So this is running off of a Raspberry Pi Zero.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They've
gotten incredibly small. That's the That's the mini computer that runs the entire thing.
Yeah, I do a lot of that stuff
too. Oh yeah, I didn't. Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah, I've been developing on the bigger ones for a while, but that
actually
opens up a whole bunch of possibilities.
It's incredibly small. Yeah.
And the rest is battery.
Yeah, it'll last like 4 or 5 days, which is impressive. Running 8 hours a day.
Cool, yeah.
What's because it.
5800 mega.
This is 10,000.
That's 10
milliamps.
Man?
Yeah.
How much was it?
Very cheap. This is actually designed in part for applications like this, running like devices, because it doesn't shut off. It monitors the power and regulates it pretty precisely. It's like $30.
There's these moments every once in a while, like when you see something like that, you're like, oh, I gotta get back into that stuff.
Because
I haven't seen it in a couple of years. Probably pretty, like they're faster and better now.
Oh, it's insane. And I think it's $5.
Yeah, I know they're cheap. Yeah. And they run like HDMI. Like it's crazy.
Yeah.
Right? Like that just seems
insane. It has HDMI. And the crazy thing is all the associated technologies are really impressive as well. So
yeah,
I can
USB.
Yeah. No, well, I can log into that thing on my phone.
Yeah.
And have a command prompt on my phone and program it and diagnose and troubleshoot.
But even the GPS devices are like, you know, it's a USB peripheral now. Instead
right.
Of like some bullshit.
Right. Yeah. No, I haven't done this kind of like custom hardware design, like custom hardware and software for a few years now. And yeah, it changes so radically every few years that.
I really think it is like one of these things where you just dive in every 5 years and it's like, oh, I can do that thing I thought of like 5 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. So that was another inspiration for this. Just like, oh, it's been a while since I did a project like this.
You know, when you're talking about, and I'm not trying to pump you for emotion or anything, that story you were about to tell, and getting a sense of.
Oh, yeah.
A book that I would recommend. If you're into like short stories and stuff, called The Overground. And it's a book about a bunch of different people's families who plant trees. And so it's this interesting there's a number of stories about different immigrant moments and, you know, colonial moments of American culture.
Sure.
And there's one in there about an Asian family and a chestnut tree that's just mind-boggling in terms of its intersection of all that stuff.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
It's called The Overstory. I forget who wrote it, but Joseph, American writer.
No, cool.
What's up?
We should make a major film out of these things.
Yeah. You like it, huh? Beautiful people. How do you go wrong? Everybody's so...
We just have to think about another place, I guess.
Okay.
In terms of light.
Then it's just Brian and then...
Just okay. Brian.
Cool. I should go to bed because I have to get up at 3 in the morning.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. I'm going to drive to the airport with that.
Oh, but you're going to Bemidji, though, right? So it's not so far.
That's okay.
Yeah, it's not so far. Not so terrible. Well, thank you for that. That was great.
Yeah, nice.
Those were really great questions.
Thank you. It's always weird to stare at someone for 45 minutes. No problem.
So you're going to be down.
How many encounters for 45 minutes did you have in your life? Sorry.
No, go.
Sorry?
How many encounters for 45 minutes?
Well, it's just.